This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633 and 877-217-5757. And Inkster Show at WRKF.org if you would like to reach us online. We begin with Bob Mirabito. He is the new Chief Executive Officer of the Capital Area Transportation System, a system that has been a source of controversy in our community for some time. And Bob Mirabito is thus far pleased with the way things are going on his watch. Good morning to you, sir.
Morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. Now, you're a native of Brooklyn, correct?
That's correct.
It's been a lot of time in Brooklyn and in New Jersey, and they've had some transportation issues there of late, as we know, as far as bridges being closed and the like. But how did you end up in Baton Rouge?
Actually, Jim, I have this is my third industry. So what brought me down to Baton Rouge was healthcare. I initially was the CIO at Baton Rouge Radiology Group, and so that's how the family got down here, and we really enjoyed Baton Rouge.
Well, you've been here about 5 years, and now you have certainly an ambitious task. The CAT system, as you know, has been fraught with controversy and complaints. What's your early read on how the system is doing right now?
The feedback that we've gotten, Jim, since we've implemented our system expansion has been very positive. I think an example of that was actually an article in The Advocate, which has not been, which has reported fairly about CATS, but a lot of the previous articles were negative because of the controversy surrounding the agency. But I think we've turned a corner. We are more focused on providing good customer service. Our buses are running more frequently as a result of the dedicated tax that was passed. So I think we've made a lot of service improvements, but we still have a long way to go.
What have you heard from the public regarding the new routes that are in place?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to be out there on the street. A lot of my staff has been out on the street. And, of course, there's a minority that, feels like we shouldn't have changed the system. But overall, I think the people are pleased because we've delivered shorter trip times, and more buses, and that allows them to get where they need to be a lot quicker than it used to be. I'll give you an example. A lot of people now need to get to Our Lady of the Lake because of the closing of Earl K. Long. Before we implemented the expansion, it would take you almost 3 hours and three buses. Now it takes 45 minutes, and it's one bus that actually goes through our Cortana Mall hub site. So I think overall I get a positive vibe from the community.
And as you pointed out at the Rotary Club a few weeks ago, bus systems are not designed to be profit centers. It's a public service, but that said, people are sensitive to cost. What is the cost to the city of Baton Rouge to run this system?
Right now, we're getting $15 million a year from the property tax referendum. Our budget for this year is $24 million total. So the difference is actually made up with federal grants that we are able to procure to help subsidize the service. In addition, we get some hotel motel tax receipts. We get a parish transit fund from the state of Louisiana, and then also we collect about $2 million in revenue. So that $24 million, the majority comes from the property tax, and of that $24 million, $3 million goes to support our paratransit service. Not a lot of people are aware, but we have something called CATS on Demand. And what that service provides is for those people that are physically or mentally challenged, they can go through a certification process, and we provide door-to-door service So if they need to go to a doctor's office, they need to go to a dialysis center, as long as they're within a three-quarter mile corridor of a fixed bus route, that's a federally mandated, it's unfunded, and so $3 million of that $24 million budget supports that service. We have become really a provider of medical transportation in Baton Rouge, and with an aging population, I think it's going to continue to grow. The remaining $21 million goes to support the fixed bus route service that's currently in place.
All right. Well, of the $24 million budget, you say $15 million comes from the taxes that were passed, but how much of the money is derived from fares?
$2 million. So, you know, our fare box recovery is roughly around 11%. So what that means is for every dollar that we spend to operate, we collect 11 cents. Most transit agencies are in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 cents. The best service out there is BART in San Francisco, and they're able to collect about 60 cents on every dollar that they have to spend to operate. So as you can see, there's no transit agency. That's why it's a public transit agency. It's, you know, the government is the provider of last resort, and in transit's case, the government provides transit service, and it's subsidized by the taxpayers in one way or the other.
And the fare, for those who are unaware?
The fares are $1.75 for a one-way trip with one transfer if you need to change buses at a quarter. They can actually purchase a $4 one-day pass, which gets them unlimited rides for a 24-hour period. Our discount rate for senior citizens, people with disabilities, and students is 35 cents a ride.
297-5633 is your number for Bob Marabito, the new CEO of CATS, Don Molino Producing. If you're calling outside the city, you may reach us toll-free, 877-217-5757. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air with Bob Marabito.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Mr. Marabito, I'm curious. I live here off North Foster Drive, and I've seen very few covered bus stops, which concerns me. I see a lot of young families and children, women with children, and they have to stand out in the sun and rain sometimes. I was wondering when we might see some of that, let's say on North Foster and Greenwell, which is really a big need. My other question is, I understand you were a chief information officer. How does one go from being an information officer to a CEO of a transportation system, and what sort of legacy plan do you have in place, let's say, if the leadership changes in the next 5-10 years?
Okay, good question, Charles. First of all, when it comes to bus shelters, right now the plan is to have 100 new bus shelters in Baton Rouge by the end of the year. We have a subcontractor, MV Transit, that is helping us make that happen. We have plans to have 8 shelters up in the next 6 weeks, an additional 12 to follow shortly thereafter. And then the additional bus shelters will be placed either through us or through the Department of Transportation and Development. They are a partner in this, but our goal is to have 100 new shelters in place by the end of the year. As far as my tenure as CIO, I can tell you I've had many jobs. As I was actually in telecom for 20 years. My last gig was as vice president for CenturyTel, which is now CenturyLink, and reported to the chief operating officer there. When I got into healthcare, I was a CIO. I actually started a company with 9 doctors and was the CEO of that opportunity. So I feel like I have a very well-rounded background that suits me well in coming into the CEO role here at CATS. It's all about leadership and communication, at this stage. And I think that you are seeing some of the benefits of having a strong leader here at the head of the agency. As far as the plans, 5 to 10 years out, you know, the CEO reports to the Board of Commissioners. I think it's a partnership, and I hope to be here for. I have a son that's 15, so he still has to go to college. So I'm thinking I'd like to stick around for another 6 to 10 years, and then at that point, it's going to be up to the CATS board to decide what direction they want to go as far as our replacement.
Okay. 297-5633, still time to get in with Bob Mirabito, the new chief executive officer of CATS. Leonard Joseph writes, every full bus can take as many as 60 cars off the road, saving citizens time and money in the millions per year. That's easier said than done, though. Many of the buses are largely unoccupied. How do you change that?
Well, I think it starts with having a strong customer focus. Before we launched on the 30th, every operator and every supervisor went through an intensive half a day's training for customer service, how to deal with the public. We're going to have a follow-up session in the next 2 or 3 months. It truly is changing the focus and saying that, you know, if we don't have riders, we don't need buses, and if we don't need buses, we don't need employees at CATS. It means listening to the ridership. It means listening to businesses as far as what the needs are in the community. The other thing that we need to focus on is we need, as part of that customer service focus is we have to increase our reliability. One of the things that we're kind of hamstrung here is that a bus costs $420,000. You just don't go down to the local dealership and purchase one off the lot. In addition to making sure that we have the federal money to help subsidize the cost of that bus, we have to plan 18 months in advance because that's how long it takes to get a bus from the day that you order it.
Barry in Mid-City. Barry, you're on the air with Bob Mirabito. Hi, Barry.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I just have a very, very small question and request. The shelter that is in front of the Chase Bank, Bob, on Corporate Boulevard, when you're leaving that Chase Bank on Corporate Boulevard, the bus stop bench prevents you from having a clear view of oncoming traffic.
Okay. Unfortunately, Barry, I don't control the bus benches. As you may be aware, and I'll make that a point to talk with DPW, but the Metro Council entered into 3 contracts with different bus bench companies. And the contract is actually between the parish and the bench company, and they have an agreement that says that wherever there's a bus stop, they're able to put a bench. I'll make David Guillory at DPW aware of your concern, and if it's a safety issue, I think the parish would be able to get that bench company to remove it.
297-5633. Few more minutes with Bob Mirabito, the new chief executive officer of the Capital Area Transportation System, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number. Bob Mirabito with us for just a bit longer. He is the new CEO of CATS. Kim in Iberville Parish. Kim, good morning. You're on the air with Bob Mirabito.
Good morning. Well, I have experience with public transportation in the city of Boston approximately 20 years ago. Walk down the block, take a bus, get to the train, maybe take another bus, but basically get anywhere I wanted to go. I had experience with the Baton Rouge bus system approximately 10 years ago. It was a complete failure. I opted out. And I also wanted to reflect on not to play word games, but you referred to the fee that one would pay, and you said that they would pay. Enable for a bus system to be complete and successful, all economic values need to ride the system. And if it's only going to be where the underprivileged feel like they need to take that bus.
All right. She takes exception to the pronoun they. I don't think you meant anything by that, but obviously Kim was revved up about it.
Okay. Well, I apologize. I didn't even know. I'm not even sure what context I was using it. What I was saying is that I want not only riders of need, but also riders of choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's the term that we use in the transit industry, and my goal is to make everybody want to take the bus, not just people who can't afford a car, for example, can't afford $3.50 for a gallon of gas.
Well, my guess is, and I'm trying not to put words in your mouth, but you have ridden a few buses in the city since you became...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the head of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, Adam Knapp, was on this show not so long ago, and of course he supported the CATS tax, and he said he had not ridden the bus in Baton Rouge.
Well, actually, Adam had. He may not have remembered, but he actually I sold him a ticket on Touchdown Express, Jim.
When was that?
Back football season.
Okay. Well, I think it was preceding that, so I'm glad he's now riding the bus. As head of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, he should.
You know, we're doing park and rides to make it attractive for people to get out of their cars. There's a lot that we can do better. I would like to see dedicated bus lanes. I grew up back east, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I used to take the bus as a kid to get to school. I used to go to high school 30 miles away, so I would take the bus and train.
Okay.
We're spread out here in Baton Rouge. We're not like Boston or New York. We're not very consolidated as far as a land goes, and so we're spread out. So it gets more costly to provide bus service. And I'm just saying that we're doing the best we can with the budget that was given to us.
Julie, in Mid-City. Good morning, Julie. You're on the air with Bob Mirabito.
Kudos on all the improvements to the bus system. And I have a comment, and I'm sorry if you've already covered this. I haven't heard the whole conversation. But I drive by the main bus terminal almost every morning, and it seems as though maybe you've added some stops right there on Florida Boulevard. I see people waiting and boarding and disboarding. And then they often run across the street, and it seems rather dangerous for the pedestrians, and I'm thinking there needs to be a designated crosswalk there.
Well, Julie, I'm glad you pointed that out. We actually have made a change. You may not have driven by in the last day or two, but we've actually removed the bus stop from the north side of Florida Boulevard. We did see people just crossing. Just so that they were in a hurry to get to their transfer. And so rather than risk someone getting hurt or killed, we removed the bus stops, and they are now on the terminal side of the street. Our buses do pull in. You know, if you go to a large city, it's typical to have a stop like we did at 22nd in Florida, because the bus can just shoot right through. And now we're pulling into the terminal, which adds about 5 minutes to travel time. You know, we're learning, and wherever there's a safety consideration, we're addressing it. But that's already been addressed.
You were quoted as saying when you received the job officially, riders want their buses to run on time. They want to know when the bus is going to be at their stop, and they want a clean bus with a courteous bus driver. All of those things you think are being accomplished now?
That's our goal. Yeah, I think that we need to get better, Jim. For example, on-time performance. We're probably running in the low 70% right now. We need to get that up. But I said all along when we implemented that we not only added 10 new routes, but we changed 19 of the existing 20. And we couldn't practice for 6 months before we went live. So I can tell you the first night I'm coming home from the office and I see a Bluebird bus on Nicholson Drive out by where I live. And we don't have bus service on Nicholson Drive. It was the LSU Cortana bus that had gotten lost. So we make mistakes and we correct them as we go along. But my goal is to have the buses run as timely as possible. We now have GPS working, and so people can go to RouteShout and download the Cat's Tracks application. They can go to our website, and they can look at the web portal, and they can see right now, I've got it in my office, I can see all the buses that are out there, and it tells me what they're running as opposed to what schedule. So I can see if we're running late. You never want to run early in the transit business, and my goal is to increase that on-time performance. We can always do better at cleaning buses. We fixed our bus wash, so now all our buses are being washed at night, we're getting better. Day by day, we're getting better.
Okay, a couple of quick questions before we let you go, Bob.
Sure.
Tom asks, what does the average bus driver earn in compensation in Baton Rouge?
Our operators start out at $12 an hour, and they can make up to $17 an hour. So roughly that's $25,000 to $35,000.
And what, they must have a clean driving record, I would think.
Yes, and then they have to get a commercial driver's license with passenger endorsement, which we actually have a third-party tester on payroll. We train them how to operate the bus, then they test, and if they get their CDL, then they're qualified to be on the road.
And Bradley asks, what role will you play in promoting public transportation, not just in regard to city buses, but high-speed rail and bus service between Baton Rouge and New Orleans? Don't know if that's your line of concentration, but I'm sure you have some thoughts about it.
Right. As the regional transit authority here, you know, we go beyond East Baton Rouge Parish, but we're only working in East Baton Rouge Parish. And I've always said that we got to fix our house first before we start going to other parishes. But I think we're going to be at the table. We want to play. We want to facilitate more transit solutions within the 6 or 7 parish areas. And if that includes making sure that, you know, if you catch a train, for example, from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, or you catch a bus from New Orleans to Baton Rouge, you've got to get down to your neighborhood. You got to get to your business. And we want to bring it all together. So we want to support any transit solutions that is going to help Baton Rouge move forward with a more vibrant transit.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it, and we look forward to getting an update from you soon. Bob Mirabito.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Bob. 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Joining us from Acadiana is Trent Angers, a prominent Louisiana writer who's written about all kinds of topics through his long and distinguished career, and his latest is the My Lai Massacre. And he has a piece that appeared in the New York Post a few days ago, as of March 15th, saying, even before Watergate brought down his presidency, Richard Nixon was the prime mover in another illegal action that could have been grounds for impeachment. It is now clear, after extensive research, that Nixon initiated the campaign to sabotage the My Lai Massacre trials so no American soldier involved in the killings would be convicted of war crimes. Good morning, Trent Angers.
Good morning, Jim.
You've done some exhaustive research on this topic, haven't you?
Yep. When I put the book out in the first place, 12 or 14 years ago, I spent a couple of thousand hours on 3 different continents writing the Hugh Thompson story, and the follow-up, the revised edition, just came out a few weeks ago, And I spent about 300 hours of interviewing and researching and thinking and figuring out some things. And we figured out that that this effort, that we knew this effort had occurred to sabotage the My Lai trials. And we now have ironclad proof that it was President Richard Nixon who initiated the effort and led the campaign to sabotage the trials so that nobody would be convicted of a war crime. Nixon did not want for it to be to go down in history that anybody was convicted of a war crime on his watch. And I needed to hasten to point out, too, that this crime at My Lai, the murder of 504 unarmed, unresisting civilians, this happened under Johnson's watch. Johnson was still president, not Nixon. And however, since the massacre, crime was covered up for more than a year. It wasn't revealed until Nixon became president, so he was stuck with the problem of how to deal with it. And the way he tried to deal with it, in part, was to make sure nobody was convicted of a war crime.
Well, he could have blamed it on Johnson, though. It did happen March 16, 1968. Why was this so important to Richard Nixon?
Well, because as the president of our country and as the commander-in-chief, I mean, he was certainly, like so many Americans, was embarrassed and ashamed of what our people had done. And by the way, I want to hasten to point out on behalf of myself, as well as Hugh Thompson, who is now deceased, that we feel that the vast majority of our men and women fought honorably in Vietnam, and a certain percentage did not. And the United States Army is an honorable institution, and what Hugh Thompson did to interfere with the massacre, it proved that the core values of the U.S. Army held up under the most adverse of conditions. Some look at this story as an anti-military, anti-war type story. And in fact, it can be said it's just the opposite, that while there was a criminal element in the Army, just as there is in every war, including the latest wars, there are war crimes that are committed. There are atrocities committed. You know, when you unleash the dogs of war, you really can't control them all the time. And the truth is, you really can't control them, well, all the time, I should say.
Right. Well, Johnson made his famous address, "I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president," on March 31st of 68. So that was just 2 weeks and a day after the My Lai massacre. Do you think there's any connection?
No, I really don't think, based on my research, that LBJ knew about this right away. I think that, since the My Lai massacre was covered up by the chain of command in Vietnam at the time, I mean, they really covered it up. And it's only a year later that Ron Ridenour's letter, his famous letter to the president and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that's what blew the lid off the cover-up. But it was very well covered up, with typical wartime propaganda. They say that the first casualty of war is the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in the case of the My Lai massacre.
Well, for those who have not been, and I suspect most of our listeners have not been to the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California, some of the most damning stuff about Nixon is in his own library, and you found what you believe is the proverbial smoking gun in this particular case.
Yes. Some historians may argue that this may or may not be the smoking gun. And however, what I have discovered through the help of researchers is handwritten notes where Nixon is dictating to his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, how they're going to cope with and try to minimize the public relations damage that the My Lai massacre was causing. And among other things, his notes says, dirty tricks, but not too high of a level. Discredit one witness, that was Hugh Thompson, and may need to use a senator or two, which was his reaching out to political allies. And the senators turned out to be congressmen, including Louisiana Congressman F. Edward Hebert and South Carolina Congressman L. Mendel Rivers. Both of these men are deceased, but both of them were really key players in the effort to sabotage the trials and by the way, to intimidate Hugh Thompson into silence. But Thompson, soldier that he was, refused to be intimidated. Well, he was mm-hmm. frightened, I will say, but he refused to. He just, as a soldier, he did his duty to testify again and again and again and again. And what he got for his trouble was to be treated as a traitor and to be treated as a rat, a guy who ratted out Charlie Company.
The only person convicted in this scandal, I think, was Lieutenant William Calley, and I think he is still alive, isn't he?
Yes, you're correct on both counts. He was the only one convicted of anything, and he lives in Atlanta right now. After the massacre, he was under house arrest for... He was given life at hard labor, and his sentence was reduced once and reduced twice, and then finally, for serving one-third of his twice-reduced sentence, he was paroled and basically set free.
The book is The Forgotten Hero of My Lai, the Hugh Thompson story, newly revised from Trent Andrews. For those who'd like to peruse a new edition, how do we do so?
Well, they can a couple of ways. In the Baton Rouge area, I know that the books are moving into the Barnes & Noble stores, and we also believe it's moving into Cottonwood Books. And then if a person wanted to get a copy immediately, they could simply go to our website, which is AcadianHouse.com, AcadianHouse.com.
The estimated dead at My Lai, 504 unarmed civilians in South Vietnam. It has to be one of the worst episodes in U.S. Military history, which largely is heroic, but in this case is tragic.
Yeah, and you know, I tried hard for 6 or 8 months to get the Vietnamese government to give up the list so I could publish it, the list of the people killed as well as their genders and their ages. And you know, a lot of Americans didn't understand the brutality of this crime, including the murder of children. There were mothers who were on the edge of this irrigation ditch holding their 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and begging for mercy.
We'll be back to wrap it up with Trent Andrews and to hear from Councilman John Delgado in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, Inkster's show at WRKF.org. And we will spend a few more minutes with Trent Andrews and then hear from the outspoken and fiery John Delgado, the councilman who manages to talk in sound bites, to say the least. Trent Andrews, this episode is a stain on the American flag. March 16, 1968, 504 unarmed civilians in South Vietnam, Vietnam were killed, and only one American has ever served any time for this, William Calley, who was released by President Nixon, I think, after, 2 years of house arrest. How many people were involved in this?
Well, there were about 105 American soldiers inserted on the ground that day. I believe 25 to 35 participated in the killing of civilians. 15 were recommended for court-martial. 5 were actually court-martialed, and only one person was convicted of anything.
And what happened to Hugh Thompson?
He died.
I know he died, but before he died, he obviously paid a price for being the person who exposed this.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was treated as a traitor by a lot of his fellow soldiers. He was a lifer in the military, a very patriotic man. He after 30 years was finally awarded the Soldier's Medal for heroism in Vietnam. There was a gentleman from South Carolina who knew of Thompson's heroism, and he campaigned the Pentagon, beat on the doors for 8 years, and got a letter-writing campaign and so forth. This guy's name is David Egan. And Egan, because of the pressure he brought, finally the Pentagon gave Hugh Thompson the Soldier's Medal, which is what he deserved, and it's the highest honor received given out by the Army for action other than combat with the enemy. And so Thompson was finally recognized for the hero that he was. By the way, I will also mention that a screenplay based on this book has recently been written, and we're hoping, with a little bit of assistance and good fortune, to have a big screen movie made based on the Hugh Thompson story.
Well, thank you. Trent Angers, the author of The Forgotten Hero of My Lai, the Hugh Thompson story, now in a newly revised edition. Good to visit with you, Trent.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. We're joined in studio by John Delgado, councilman from Baton Rouge, lawyer and owner of Huey's. How's it doing?
Huey's is doing great.
Huey's is doing well, right on 3rd Street. So John is a man about town. I see him regularly at DiGiulio's.
Indeed.
So John Delgado, you're running for mayor, is that right?
That's not exactly right, Jim. Not today.
Not yet, but you're thinking about it. Is that right?
I mean, of course, we always think about things.
I'm not thinking about it, but you are. But at any rate, you're certainly a man who doesn't shy away from controversial issues. And last week, Councilman Delgado was involved in a controversy. But this week, you're hot and bothered about what happened in the Louisiana House. 67 lawmakers voted to keep an unconstitutional law. On the books. What's going on with the Louisiana House of Representatives?
Well, I'll tell you, Jim, and thank you for having me on the show to talk about this today. The decision by the House on April 15th really was a sad day for the Constitution in the state of Louisiana. It was a rejection of the law of the land, the decisions of the Supreme Court that were made in 2003, which said that basically, sodomy provisions in criminal laws were unconstitutional, and that we all have an inherent right to privacy, fundamentally ensconced in the Constitution, and that when laws are created that impedes that right, they are void. Mm-hmm. And so Louisiana has had this law on the books for many, many years. This law, because it's on the books, even though it's unenforceable and unconstitutional, this law was the basis for the sheriff's office to arrest 16 men last summer, and they've been arresting people under this unconstitutional law for 10 years now, because the law was declared unconstitutional in 2003. Every time that this has happened, it exposes the sheriff's department and the city parish of Baton Rouge to a lawsuit. And so it's really, it seemed like a common sense solution now to take an unconstitutional law off the books. You know, but to borrow a phrase, it seems like we never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And here we had a chance to take this law off the books. It passed out of committee 9-6, and yet
only 27 votes in the House.
It only got 27
out of 105. And so the remainder, and by the way, there were 11 who sat on the sidelines intentionally for the most part. Only 27 people voted the way you wanted them to, in a way I'm sure many of our listeners would like. Based on this law, heterosexual couples, married people, could be arrested, convicted, and serve hard time if it was constitutional.
That is true. It is the ultimate nanny state law. When we talk about, you know, big government, how much bigger can government get than when it starts intruding into your private acts in your bedroom?
Mm-hmm. 297-5633 is your number. John Delgado, councilman from Baton Rouge, District 12, is our guest. And why are you involved so intensely on this issue?
Well, to me, it's a human rights issue. And I think that where we, you know, maybe I'm just one of those guys when, you know, when I see something wrong, I stand up, I call it wrong, and I try and stop it. And this has been, I think, part of the history of this state for some time, is to kind of take these more conservative positions on issues, and I think it does so to our detriment. You know, we want to bring in businesses, we want to bring in the film industry, we want to bring in the digital media industry. When these events like happened last summer where the sheriff's office occur, it casts a black eye on the entire state. And so I think it hurts our business development, it hurts our ability to bring in tourists here, and I think it's just something that's wrong and needs to be fixed.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if Louisiana gets a lot of national exposure as a result of this. For the most part, the result has been a kind of a yawn, surprisingly. You've got people who are erudite souls like Representative Steve Carter. He voted to keep the unconstitutional law. He's one of 67 members of the House, not to single out Representative Carter, but some other members in Baton Rouge, Eric Ponte, voted with Steve Carter and 65 others. Who in Baton Rouge voted the way you would like, other than the Black Caucus, which seems to be one of the few entities, for the most part, that is supportive of overturning this?
Well, I think the attorney in the delegation, Franklin Foyle, voted the way that I think the law would require us to vote, which
he did.
To remove an unconstitutional law from the books. You know, it's interesting, to give a little history, if you look back at other times when this has happened in the United States, in 1967, the Supreme Court declared that the anti-miscegenation laws in the state of Virginia, in the famous case of Loving versus Virginia, that those laws were unconstitutional. Now, the state of Virginia waited 8 years to remove its law from the books, but the law was still unconstitutional and unenforceable, even though the state of Virginia waited 8 years to take it off the books. The same law that existed in the state of Louisiana, again, an anti-miscegenation law that said whites and blacks could not marry or cohabit, that law stayed on the books in Louisiana until 1983, so 16 years post the Supreme Court decision. In the state of Alabama, they left the same law, the same racist anti-miscegenation law, on the books until 2000, 33 years after the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. I think, again, that we had here an opportunity to take a law that was a clearly came from a bigoted intent, and take it off the books, show the nation that we are a progressive state, that we are a forward-thinking state, and again, we missed the opportunity.
297-5633 is your number. John Delgado with us. Louisiana's anti-sodomy law remains on the books. At least a dozen men have been arrested for violating the unconstitutional law, and of course, Hiller Moore, the DA here in Baton Rouge, didn't proceed because he knows fully well that the law is not enforceable. But the opponents, and this came up in the discussion on the floor, talked about God and gay cruising sites and maintaining family-friendly environments for children. Do you think they're being unfair in this, singling out gay people, for example? I think a lot of heterosexuals engage in the kind of behavior that's spelled out in this law. Why aren't heterosexual people spelled out?
It's hard for me to talk about it on the radio, Jim, because I'm not sure exactly what's going to get me bleeped here. But basically, I mean, an anti-sodomy law, what we have is called a crime against nature law, and basically excludes any type of sexual conduct between consenting adults or otherwise, but between consenting adults.
Between married couples.
Between married couples, other than missionary position, basically. And so when you are taking that type of reading of the law and you're going to apply that to everyone, it's just a silly law to have on the books in the first place. So they're going to focus on what they want to focus on to keep the law on the books, but basically it's just one group of people telling another group of people that they are different and inferior by virtue of being different.
Does this emphasize the clout of the Family Forum?
I think it does show how powerful they are in this state. I think it's a sad thing to say, but it's true.
Now, you have stated in other places and on this show that you're going to take the one Baton Rouge level or issue to a different level with an ordinance that you would like to have passed. Do you really think you got a shot with the current configuration of the city council?
I got to tell you, I keep having hope in my fellow man, whether it's misplaced or not. But I believe that ultimately, when you give people the opportunity to say, are we going to discriminate or not? Do you support discrimination or not? Do you want to treat people equally and fairly under the law? I have to hope that my colleagues would support that. And so I know that Denise Marcel has come out recently, and actually I say recently, she's proposed a measure recently, but she has been long supportive of preventing discrimination. Yeah. And so I think that with her proposed ordinance, when it ultimately comes, hopefully it'll pass.
Okay. And I've gotten a few inquiries about the move yesterday. It looks like the St. George election window could be narrowed. That's the top story in The Advocate. Is this a good thing?
I think it's a good thing to pause and think about the process of incorporation, not only for what goes on in East Baton Rouge Parish, but across the state. There's another city, Watson, that's looking at incorporating. Mm-hmm. The fact that when we try to create a school system, if you want to create your own school system, it has to go to the legislature and it has to go to a statewide vote. But if you're trying to create a city, an entirely new governmental entity, it's only decided upon by the people in that particular area. And so I think that this is fine in closing off the open-ended nature of the petition drive, but I think it's more important to look at Representative James's bill, which is House Bill 1212, which would say that if you're going to create a city, then the people in the proposed city need to support it, and the people in the parish where that proposed city would be situated need to support it. I think that's a common sense solution.
But some would say that's changing the rules in midstream.
Well, and it certainly would be changing the rules of midstream, but these are rules that probably needed to be changed 50, 60 years ago. We just haven't gotten around to it yet.
And
once again, we never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
In politics, it's generally all about winning, right?
I think in life it's all about winning, but in politics it's all about doing the right thing, I hope.
Okay. 297-5633, a few more minutes with John Delgado, the outspoken member of the Metro Council. Michelle in South Downs. Michelle, you're on the air with John. Hi, Michelle.
Now, if John...
This obviously isn't Michelle. Who is calling?
Michael.
Okay, Michael. Go ahead.
I'd like to find out why he gave a pass to Tommy Spinoza on the Roseanne Project and allowed the housing situation to be changed in South Downs.
All right.
Sure, it's a little off topic, but I'm happy to address the issue. I assume that they're referring to the unanimous vote of the council last night to modify the Unified Development Code. There was a First Circuit decision that recently came out that affected the Roseanne development. Now, you've got about 40 people who have already purchased homes and lots within that development who were seriously impacted by this First Circuit decision. And also, all TND's traditional neighborhood developments throughout the city parish were impacted by this decision, because basically it said anytime that you create a TND, if there is a servitude anywhere within that TND, it is invalid. Well, there are servitudes of all kinds all over the place, and so you really could never create a traditional neighborhood development in EBR based on that First Circuit decision. And so what we did was modify the UDC to allow for the creation of TNDs.
Right. Do you live in that area?
I live in the South Downs area, yes.
What do you think about those Section 8 signs in the neighborhood?
That is my controversial friend, Steve Myers, who I think does a better job of getting on the news than I do.
Is that a yes or a no as far as the signs? By the way, I noticed the one on Morning Glory has been removed.
I think a sign gets removed about every other day. Steve, I think, probably bought about 1,000 of them just to replace it. I think that... clearly, Section 8 has a bad connotation, and you know it is a slight against the area to say, this is a Section 8 house. But quite frankly, any rental property can be Section 8. You could rent a mansion at Section 8. Now you're only going to get paid the legal maximum, which is like $1,500 a month. But you could rent a $1 million house out and take Section 8 tenants.
Okay, here's a comment from Stephen Dixon saying, one thing we have to prove when bringing a civil rights case is that there has been a deliberate indifference in respect to violating a constitutional right. We will be able to show deliberate indifference after this downright intentional prelude to violating the constitutional rights of our LGBT fellow citizens, our brothers and sisters. My hat's off to John Delgado. His position is a true breath of fresh air. So there's one for John.
Thank you, Steve.
And... You think you're going to be okay with the organizers of St. George, or shall we not have the two of you or the many of you in the same room?
I'm happy to sit down in the same room with anybody. You know, I argue for a living, so I'm happy to take my point and put it out there and have everyone else do the same. I respect their opinions.
And you stand by what you said?
I always do.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, John, and we're glad you speak your mind. That's what it's all about.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. And we'll be back tomorrow for Don Molino. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.